Good morning, evening, afternoon. My name is Chris.
My name's Martin. That was unexpected.
This is Extra Sequential. We are a weekly podcast coming at you from a little, I was going to say a little hobbit.
But little Hamlet.
Hamlet, that's what I'm looking for, thank you. with round doors and everything, called Perth in Western Australia.
Yeah, it's a show where we talk about comics, graphic novels, manga, and pop culture-y stuff.
We do, and we ramble and basically just have a good old time. Gay old time.
Well done. This week won't have any particular theme, but we will be discussing the Super Bowl comic book trailers that have been coming out. A few other news item tidbits. I'm going to be talking about a couple of the comics I picked up in my Melbourne travels, some zines and so forth. And Chris will have some goodies for you as well.
I've always got goodies, baby. It's what I do. It's how I operate. It's the kind of man that I am.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure what to say.
Let's talk about the news.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I'll start with this one because this intrigued me. Do you remember a few years ago, Robert Rodriguez was queued up to direct and, I guess, write and direct a version of Red Sonja for the big screen?
And yes, it was in development. They released a poster, I think, as far as I got, starring Rose McGowan, ex-girlfriend of Marilyn Manson, and she replaced, what's-her-face, Shannon Doherty in Charmed, the TV series.
That's true, yeah. And it was interesting at the time because they did these mock-ups of, like, I think to try and get investors on board, you know, of what the film could look like. It looked fairly interesting. But that's all fallen through. You said they used to date and now they've broken up, so he doesn't want a director. And with the Conan film coming out, well, they have to release another film to sort of tie in with that. So they are going to continue on with Red Sonja. Simon West is going to may direct. Amber Heard, who I've never heard of before, will be starring as the titular Red Sonja, but she's a blonde, so not a fan.
Well, I can only imagine they dye their hair. Actresses do have that ability to dye their hair.
Yeah,
it's part
special
of the
effects.
Chameleon role they inhabit.
Yes.
The Cape Blanchett effect. Amber Heard, she's one of those, you know, hot young blondes.
20-somethings.
There are so many. Yeah,
huge rack.
Of which we know none of. Do we? Not really. Maybe you do, because you're quite more popular than me. So what is this? A definite thing? She's definitely been casted. And Simon West, that name sounds vaguely familiar. Did he direct, like, The Fugitive or something?
He directed Drive Angry, which I've not heard of.
Starring Nicolas Cage.
Oh, is that it? Yeah, seeing his names come up.
Nicolas Cage is becoming the new Steven Seagal.
I know.
It's full of such promise.
And I think Millennium and New Image will be developing the film. So, and there's a producer on board doing that, so we'll see what happens. But I think they're going to see how well Conan does, and if there's enough enthusiasm for that, they'll quickly get this out there. I'm looking forward to that Conan film, actually.
I would have preferred the Robert Rodriguez is the guy that did Sin City.
Yes.
And
some other
Spy Kids.
the 3D one,
but yeah, his approach would have been pretty awesome. I would have thought it's pretty. He's a pal of Quentin Tarantino and those guys. Mm. They did the Planet Terror. I think he did Rodriguez when they did the Grindhouse films.
And yeah, I never watched that.
Death Proof. Mm. It's not bad. But yeah, it's unfortunate. But nonetheless, Red Sonja is a fairly interesting character. The last time was starring Bridget Nielsen.
Yeah,
back in the '80s, wasn't it?
I remember trying to watch that. It's so tedious. Really? Arnold Schwarzenegger pops in and out, like not as Conan, but as like a different character because there was a rights issue. He's not in the whole film. She has this annoying Asian sidekick, kind of like Short Round from what I remember. She's not good in it. The special effects are corny. We had to turn it off halfway through because we got so bored.
Wow, that's unusual. You seem to like your cheesy sword and sandals epics.
Yeah, I like them when they're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the key link that joins them together. I have high hopes for Conan because...
Yes.
Yeah, Shelley really loves the dude who plays...
Momoa.
Yeah, Jason Momoa. Yeah, he looks the part. He's looking He's looking swarthy enough. He's quite bulked up. I think he's, half Hawaiian or something? I don't know. Yep. Maybe it's just because he was on Baywatch Hawaii. So
oh, wow.
Things are blending in my mind. But that looks pretty decent. And the set photos they released look pretty cool. Kind of Pirates of the Caribbean-ish. They looked that level. So I'm like, okay, for a cheaper film. Well done, guys. But that's enough about that. What else you got?
Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, 125, 130, 140,000 people every year. It's the biggest pop culture exhibition, well, in the English language speaking world anyway. Right. Comic-Con tickets, they've all sold out for this year. It's held in July every year. So if you're hoping to go for Comic-Con this year, it's a whole four-day event. All four-day passes and single-day passes are gone.
Mm.
They tried three times and the system kept crashing. I think they tried two or three different companies because the traffic was just immense and it sold out in like a couple of hours. So if you're really desperate to go, you can wait for refunded tickets, which does happen, or you can go to, I think the website's comiccon.org, and you can become a volunteer. And that basically means you work the floor for a couple hours a day and you get free access. So you might be carrying, bringing stars from one stage to the next stage kind of thing. And so it's a good way to kind of meet celebrities if you want to meet, you know, Lou Ferrigno or Josh Whedon or Robert Downey Jr. I don't know. So
yeah, there's a lot of movie stars there now, aren't there?
It's a huge pop culture thing. The cast of the Avengers there was assembled there for the first time last year. It's I mean, people complain that it's more about movies than comics, but that's not true. I mean, I've been twice, and it's awesome, and I always come back with a load full of comics. So, yeah, it's sold out. Mm. Let's talk about trailers. Super Bowl was on last weekend, and that means nothing to either of us. The Green Bay Packers were fighting the Detroit Oilers. I don't even know.
Who won?
Somebody won. There was guys with helmets and big shoulder pads throwing things.
Is that to look tough? Is that like to intimidate the opponents, like a haka or something? Like,
no, that's just the standard. They're not, you know, tough like our Australian rules footy players.
Yeah, Australian rules footy players don't even bother with sleeves. It's not even like huge puffy shoulder things. Whenever I see Super Bowl things, the American football costumes, I think of like 80s power businesswomen with the shoulder pads. Something Bridget Nelson would wear.
We probably do have a lot of American listeners, so we shouldn't make fun of them.
But we make fun of your national sport.
I suppose they do actually run at each other, like
Chris,
rhinos.
Do you really think anyone listening to a comic book podcast is a Super Bowl fan, like into sports and stuff?
Good call.
Yeah.
But heaps of trailers were shown.
Yes. Mm. And they're all like mini things. They're like 30 seconds long. And
yes, they cost, I think, $3 million or something for a 30
to get those slots, and it's really competitive. And with Super Bowl, they're just kind of teaser trailers. They just show off the little best cool bits of the film, and it's the way to reach the widest audience. So they don't have time to put any talking or plot in there. It's just bam, 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 bam. And we saw a few. I guess the first one we should talk about is Thor, just to get that cab off the rank.
Thor, based on the obviously next cab in the rank, as we talked about Avengers. So before the individual Avengers have their own films, Iron Man, Hulk, Thor, followed by Captain America, before they all come together in next year's the Avengers film, directed by Joss Whedon. Next up is Thor, directed by Kenneth Branagh, Shakespearean actor and director. And the first trailer from Thor came out a couple of months ago. There was a lot of different footage shown in the Super Bowl trailer, particularly Natalie Portman. Speaking, who plays a nurse, Jane Foster, speaking with Thor, played by Aussie actor Chris Hemsworth, who played Captain Kirk's dad in the Star Trek remake.
Was he in Home and Away as well?
He was in Home and Away.
Okay.
As all good Aussie actors are.
It's true, eh?
Except if Crow was in it. It showed different footage. It seems to have a lot more of a Lord of the Rings vibe.
I think they're showing off the Asgard stuff. Is it called Asgard? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know if Marvel changed
it. Thor is the god of thunder, so he basically gets so proud, and he basically Asgard gets invaded by some snow giants or something. So his dad, Odin, banishes him to Earth and kind of strips him of his power. So he lands in Earth and he doesn't really know what he is and what he's doing, and so he kind of has to redeem himself to get his power back and his hammer back and smash some bad guys. So Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson, was in there, and it's got a few more Avengers tie-ins.
Yeah.
It looks good. I'm actually probably more excited about this one than the Captain America one.
I had to really force myself to watch this trailer. I couldn't do it.
What, the Captain America one?
No, either of them. Interest in Thor is so low. But the plot of this reminds me of Hercules in New York. Same thing. He's too proud.
Yeah.
My father, the deity. Yeah.
Thor opens in May. We should point out.
Yeah.
Opening in, I think, July is Captain America, the First Avenger. In some places, just known as the First Avenger, where some countries where they don't like America.
Ah, okay. And is this our first look at the film footage of that
This is the first ever official trailer that was shown at Super Bowl. If you just Google them, or you'll find them online if you haven't seen them already. Basically, Captain America is one of Marvel's first heroes, created by Jack Kirby, the legendary Jack Kirby artist who worked a lot with Stan Lee and Joe Simon.
Mm-hmm.
World War II hero. He's been around since the 40s. Scrawny guy, enlisted in the army. And then they give him this enlist him in the Super Soldier program, of which he's the only successful test subject. So he gets lots of muscles and becomes a patriotic hero, and beats the Nazis, gets frozen in ice. And then when he wakes up decades later, he helps form the Avengers. So he will be appearing in the Avengers. But most of the Captain America film is set in World War II. And I believe it has bookends at the start and the end, just set in the modern era. Starring Chris Evans, who most of you will know as Johnny Storm, Human Torch. Recently killed off by Marvel in a page of the Fantastic Four.
Or from Scott Pilgrim or Sunshine, or any number of films which he's actually good in.
True. Yeah. It seems a bit weird. It was funny when I walked into the comic shop today, they were watching the X-Men First Class trailer, which came out today.
Okay.
And we were talking about Captain America, and a few of us said that it looks a bit weird in the trailer, Chris Evans' head on a scrawny little body.
CGI to make him? Definitely. He's not that small. I thought that was interesting, because that's what I vaguely remember about Captain America, that he was basically like the Atlas guy. You know, he starts off skinny and then kind of that. And, it looked weird, but... at least his face wasn't CG, and it was such short clips. And apparently there you can briefly see the Red Skull.
Skull is there, played by Hugo Weaving, who most of you know, another Aussie actor from The Matrix, from Mr. Anderson, bad guy in The Matrix. So, you see him. The Captain America trailer is a lot more fast-paced than the Thor one, so you're going to have to pay attention. But, Hugo Weaving kind of rips his face off, and you see the Red Skull, literally, who's like a Nazi-ish bad guy. And you see everything. You see him in the costume, which has been updated in the modern comics recently, so it doesn't look as daggy. It looks more like an actual military outfit. You see him with his shield, and it looks pretty good. Interesting to see how they tie this World War II set Captain America film into the modern day Avengers, where he gets frozen in ice. I'd imagine they probably put him on.
Be like Encino Man.
Put a big carbonite or something. Put Captain America in the cargo hold.
That's very good.
So I don't know. X-Men First Class.
Okay. That's not a Super Bowl trailer, is it?
No.
Because the other trailer that just briefly mentioned, it was Cowboys versus Aliens, and that was a Super Bowl one. And Captain America, so much is going on and stuff flying at the screen. Things are exploding. But I think it looks like a pretty fun trailer. That film looks just so dumb that I think I'd enjoy it.
Based on an old comic. But I do remember reading an interview with the filmmaker saying they agonized over which hat to give Harrison Ford, Daniel Craig, Harrison Ford in it, and they didn't want to make Harrison Ford, because it's a Western, they didn't want to make him look like Indiana Jones, so they kept choosing different hats. So people would say, hey, there's Indiana Jones, what's he doing in this movie?
Did Steven Spielberg have something to do with this film? I feel like he was executive producer in some capacity. John Favreau was directing it, is that correct?
Yes, who directed the first two Iron Man films, but he's not directing Iron Man 3.
Cool. All right. Well, I like the first Iron Man, and I think he could make this a really fun tone. And this, it looks like they finished a lot more of the special effects, because there's cool little alien glider things lifting cowboys up with laser beams and stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting mashup of genres, so it'll be pretty cool. I don't know if I'll see it in the cinema, but I'll certainly see it on DVD.
Now we can mention... X-Men First Class, because that was X-Men that online?
First Class is basically Fox's... See, before Marvel had their own film studio with Iron Man, all the X-Men films were made, which put Marvel as a potential film company on the map, the three X-Men films. So the first one, I think, was in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically Fox Studios' attempt to hang on to the X-Men franchise. They don't want to give it to Marvel because it is a moneymaker. So this is a prequel. It stars, so we go back to the days in the 60s where we have a younger Magneto and a younger Professor X who's walking around and has hair, played by James McAvoy, who was in Wanted.
Oh, name a better film he's in. Come on.
Chronicles of Narnia.
Okay.
Just done this. Stars another Aussie actor, Rose Byrne, and a bunch of people. So Beast is in there, but mainly it'll be newer characters that weren't in. I don't think Wolverine or anyone's going to show up.
Thankfully.
But, Mystique, and it's definitely set in the 60s, because we discussed this earlier, like the Wolverine Origins film. It could have been set in any time frame, but this is definitely set in the 60s. The trailer shows JFK talking, there's talk of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
The outfits are very 60s. Kevin Bacon is in there. So
Kevin Bacon's very 60s, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. What? It's, the costume is very 60s.
Oh, Kevin Bacon's costume, okay. Because I saw some stills and there were dudes in hoodies and stuff, and I was thinking, are hoodies very 60s? I feel like hoodies are like a post-70s thing. Maybe it's like a college thing. Maybe they wore them in colleges and it didn't become cool until later. I don't know. But it looks modern to me. Maybe I'm just picky, but they look very
modern. It's interesting. It's basically... Magneto, Professor X, obviously in the first three X-Men films, they were, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. This is when they were still friends, and we've seen this so many times before, but they were still friends, and then we were seeing the Smallville or Star Wars, and every film adaptation tries to do this. You know, before they were enemies, they were the best of friends, which is kind of true. In the comics they were friends. I don't know if they're best friends, but anyway, but yeah, and their differing ideologies and how that Charles sets up, you know, the X-Men and the school to kind of teach mutants to use their powers, and Magneto goes the other way and believes the mutants should rule the Earth and kill everyone who disagrees with him.
Okay.
Another interesting film.
Who else is in this? The slutty guy from Skins? The English Skins? I can't remember his name now.
Nicholas Holt, I think.
Oh, you're very good at this.
Beast.
Yeah.
I seem to remember actors' names.
Yeah, you're much better at this. And he looks a lot like the kid who is in X-Men 3, The Last Stand, as the little kid who nullifies other mutants' X-Men powers.
Ah, okay. Yes,
I reckon in the face, that's all I see when I see him. But
yes,
yeah.
Yeah, right. He's got the weird eyebrows.
Do you know which other mutants are set to appear in this? I'm curious.
Nightcrawler's dad is in it. Mystique is in it. I think Emma Frost is in it, who's currently... sleeping with the girlfriend in the comics of Scott Summers, aka Cyclops.
Okay, I saw a dude who had Cyclops powers, but from his hands.
I think that's Havoc, Cyclops' brother.
Okay. What? Havoc, his brother? Summers. He must be a lot older.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking about, because it's set in the 60s, and you think like Professor X and Magneto, so they must be at least 30, so they were born in the 1930s.
Well, okay. That sort of makes sense for Magneto, because at the beginning of X-Men, Magneto is in the concentration camp. Pronounce Magnet? He's in the concentration camp, so his age makes sense. I always pictured him being slightly older than Professor X, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, could be right there.
Except he stays really, really fit in the comics.
Oh, he does. You know, everybody in comics has a body like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
More like Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone has kept his figure through steroids a lot better.
That's true, and he's very veiny.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
I'm so veiny.
He's like one of those old dudes you see at the beach who are super fit, but their skin is like dried leather, and yeah.
I can't say I really go to the beach and look at...
You don't leave the house much. Take a comic. Go to the beach, Chris. Take a beach comic. Take Archie. Archie's a good beach comic. I could read Archie at the beach. I don't want to read Archie, but I'll read it at the beach.
While we're on the subject of films,
are
Superman.
We?
Right.
Yep.
Zack Snyder, 300 Watchmen, is directing the Man of Steel reboot, where you talked last week or the week before about Henry Cavill, the Jewish actor, being cast. And there's been a lot of talk about female casting. And originally, all these different female actresses were throwing their name into the ring, and then people said, oh, no, they're not testing for Lois Lane. So people thought, what? Lois Lane's not going to be in it. Lois Lane will be in the Superman film that I think comes out next year. But they're not up to casting that yet. They're currently casting Ursa, who is the bad Kryptonian villain. Some of you may remember from the Christopher Reeve Superman 2 film. And in the comics, she is the lover of Zod.
So is Zod going to be in this?
Zod is not going to be in it.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
So people are kind of curious. See, my in the comics... Ursa and Zod in the Phantom Zone, even though they're kind of like ghosts in the Phantom Zone, which is, again, you'll see in Superman, where Jor-El, Superman's father, banishes the three Kryptonians into the Phantom Zone, where like a kind of a negative space, you just kind of float around like ghosts. Nothing's tangible. In the comics a couple of years ago, Ursa and Zod found this tangible like place, like pocket in the Phantom Zone. They had a kid, and I think they called them, so they came back to Earth, broke out of the Phantom Zone, and their kid basically turned against their parents, and Clark Kent, Lois Lane, I think named him Chris Kent, and adopted him.
Ba, ba, ba.
And, he's now a teenager because he went through this aging process, which happens all the time in comics. Whenever there's a kid, they'll go through some scientific magical thing and they'll age, so they're a teenager, so they can suddenly do much more of them. Anyway,
makes sense, yeah.
So, I mean, maybe Ursa will come to Earth out of the Phantom Zone carrying Urza and Zod's baby.
Okay.
I don't know. That's what I'm thinking. Who
is
knows?
This like a... are they... so Superman Returns, was that supposed to carry on from the original Superman movies? Was that the idea?
It was set after Superman 2.
So it was... So they just pretended 3 and 4 didn't happen? The one with Richard Pryor and the Nuclear Man?
Correct.
And I can't remember if there was another one.
No, 3 and 4, that was it.
Okay.
Superman Returns.
So those two didn't happen, right? And and this new one, is that going to continue?
Superman Returns isn't...
It's not connected?
Considered, as far as I know. It's Man of Steel, the new film we're talking about, is a reboot, so it's not going to...
Okay, all right.
Allude to the earlier films. But one thing that does make me happy, and I mentioned this in my blog last night, is that Zack Snyder said he does want his Superman to be a lot more physical and visceral. So we in talking about the fights, because in Superman Returns, Superman didn't even fight anybody. He didn't throw a punch.
Who could he fight? Like, if he punches someone, it's like when someone with army training gets in a bar brawl, they immediately get done for assault with a deadly weapon. That's true. Yeah, because you've had, like, army training to... I'd imagine Superman's the same thing. A single punch would, like, punch him through the head.
Well, he was powerless for a while, you know, in the Superman Returns film when he had kryptonite around him. But, yeah, he didn't... I mean, yeah, the last time he punched anyone was, when he fought Nuclear Man, so...
Nuclear Man.
And the Christopher Superman 4.
I remember. But, he throws him in a smokestack, right?
Does he?
Yeah.
Superman 2 is the best comic movie fight scene ever. 14 minutes it goes for. That's the one where the Coke billboard explodes and buses get thrown around and...
Is it like a comedy fight scene? Like,
no, it's awesome.
Do like kids' ice cream cones fly out of their hands, and does an old man like not notice because he's reading his newspaper?
Well, that does happen, but nonetheless,
best fight scene ever. Okay.
Because it captured the spirit of these Marvel movies.
Yeah, I get you.
They're so epic, and it's kind of unfortunate that no modern day. Yeah, I mean, X-Men 3, I guess, was kind of close, but.
Question.
There was lots of people fighting lots of other people.
Oh, yeah. And the people
two
just...
was just four people fighting.
And it is kind of like the people are just kind of in the background. You don't really see them die. Or it's not like a scene like in Return of the Jedi where the Ewoks are kicking ass and then one Ewok dies and everything stops and then the other Ewok goes, ooh, and he nudges him and he's like, it's the saddest moment ever. And there's nothing like that in any of the Superman films. Like... He's fighting Nuclear Man, and then
in the Superman one, Lois dies.
That's not sad. She comes back. He reverses time by something ridiculous. He spins the Earth around backwards, right?
Still my favorite movie, even though.
Okay, it's really long, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
I remember being pretty good.
I love the music. I had
great theme.
Superman on VHS, and I used to just. Fast forward until the end and just listen to John Williams' soundtrack over the end credits because I love that music.
Oh, I've just realized we've been going for like 23 minutes.
Last thing, comicsalliance.com is now the most visited comics website in America. So comicsalliance.com, more than Newsarama or a Bleeding Cool comic resource. It's only been going for just over a year.
Yeah.
Most visited as in stats-wise. So it's no mean feat. And they don't do... like reviews and interviews, like a lot of comics websites. They do more humor pieces, articles, that kind of stuff. So, I've only just hooked onto it for the last couple of months, and I've got it on my bookmark. So, congratulations to comicsalliance.com. They do different stuff than the glut of comics websites out there. So, congratulations to them.
Yeah, I do like their site. And I just realized it's less of a news item, but more of a plug for something, which is awesome, and it does tie into what I've been reading. I was just in Melbourne, picked up a whole bunch of comics, but I stopped at the ACMI, which is like a technology gallery underneath Fed Square. If you're in Melbourne at all, go check out the Dreams Come True exhibit, which is the art of Disney's classic fairy tales. It's pretty awesome. What they do with Snow White, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Little Mermaid, and Beauty and the Beast, and then the two new ones, which names I can't remember. They show... And some of the pre ones like, what's it called, Steamboat Mickey and all that. They show all mm-hmm. the concept art and sketches and storyboards and pencil roughs and the original concept. Sorry, I mentioned that already. But like all the process stuff and seeing it over a period of from their very earliest films to their newest films, it's really, really engaging to look at. And I thought it would be quite light on, like a bit Disneyland-ish, but really it was, it's in a, like a museum slash gallery thing. And they presented it that way and I really enjoyed it. And I think anyone who's at all interested in animation or maybe the process of that, or even if you just have a bit of nostalgia for these films, go down because you won't regret it. It's wonderful.
Nice one.
Yes. I think it's about time we got into what we've been reading.
Let's do it.
As I briefly mentioned a second ago, I was just in Melbourne, Victoria, for you US listeners out there, both of you.
How long did it take you to get down a plane? Let's be educational.
I think it's 4 hours from Perth to Melbourne. And I think it's,
and what's the time difference?
It's 3 hours. So if you're traveling from Melbourne to Perth, it's almost like no time has passed. I think when it's daylight savings, it's even better. I can't remember. But
did you watch a movie on the plane?
Nah, I flew with a budget airline, so there was no movies. But on my way back, the whole row was empty. So I got to stretch out, which was something I've never gotten before, and it was wonderful. But Melbourne's a great city to visit, and they have a thriving zine Arty. Culture. Yeah, our art culture. And for anyone who doesn't know what a zine is, they're kind of the grungy version of magazine. So like homemade, home published, home bound, like a lot of the time hand drawn, just stapled together little paper magazines, and in some cases comics. And there's a whole bunch of comics in Melbourne that you can grab hold of. Not as many in Perth, unfortunately, but I've seen some of these before. I picked up a little handful, and I thought I'd just mention a couple which were interesting. There's one called Modern Gentleman 3, which is through Pleasant Productions. It's an R18 restricted comic, issue 3. And it's one of the most fetid, sexually perverse comics I've ever seen.
Did you know this when you picked it up?
Yeah, that's why I picked it up, because I was like, oh, this is crazy. There's, what's his name, Little Huey? Do you remember Little Huey or Baby Huey?
No, I do not.
Giant chicken in like a diaper, Baby Huey. Anyway, there's like a scene where he... They trick him into smoking pot, and then he gets ass raped in prison. There's my favorite story. There's a whole bunch of nutty ones, some which I can't even describe them because I promised to make this like a PG show for you. So I honestly can't even tell people what happens in most of these. But okay. It's so crazy, perverse, twisted. I really enjoyed it. It's quite funny at times, quite insane. There's one bit where a woman sort of wakes up out of a stupor. She's drawn hideously, by the way, kind of Ted McKeever-ish. Picture that sort of art. Yep. She wakes up, and then I can't even read what she says in the dialogue. It's so it's so inappropriate. And then, she gives birth to a dog because she had sex with a dog. My favorite one is these two dudes go to a ski lodge, and they get snowed in, so they decide to have sex with each other. And then this weird demon ghost appears to them, and it's drawn hideously. Anytime anyone says anything slightly sexual, their faces turn into like these grinning death head things, which are repulsive. It's insane. If you can stomach it, I'd check these guys out. Yeah, cool Melbourne comic from Pleasant Productions. Yeah, check them out. Awesome stuff. And the other zine I thought I'd mention is called Summer Tears, which is completely on the other spectrum. It's like a sweet little romantic comic, kind of drawn in a whimsical, curvy line, like summer, springtime picnic kind of comic is the way I describe it. And it's the first part of a I suppose like a 4-part mini. It's like a relationship thing, but I like the presentation, like grey pages inside, pencil artwork with red highlights. Very very sweet. Summer Tears number one, and I'm just trying to get the artist name. Written by Harley Pagist. Oh my god. Okay.
Sure.
Illustrated by Andrea Manica. So I'm just trying to give him a plug because it's kind of nice. Very pretty. I'd recommend picking it up. There you go.
Summer Tears.
Summer Tears. And I'm hoping it gets in some sort of form of collection because it's quite pretty, quite sweet. The artwork's kind of like... I don't know if you ever read Perry Bible Fellowship, but whenever he'd do like a sweet one, like a saccharine kind of one, that's what the artwork looks like. Okay. But it's quite a nice little object of art. And the other zines I want to give a bit of a deeper look, so I might review them next week. What else you got?
Cool. I watched Dinner for Smucks.
Schmucks.
Don't watch it.
Don't watch
it's it? It's a remake of a French film. It stars Steve Carell. It basically plays the same part he does in The Office. And it's got the guy, one of the guys from The Flight of the Conchords, and he's trying to be the same kind of character that Russell Brand was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, this kooky artist, sexy type. Doesn't work. Paul the only Rudd thing funny and, about this yeah. film is the outtakes.
Yeah, I find that's cheap. Like, that same thing happens in so many of these terrible films, like, and always Steve Carell's in them, Get Smart, and
yeah.
That one where he's Noah and he's building the Ark, and Morgan Freeman.
Evan Almighty.
Yeah, which is a sequel to that Jim Carrey film.
Bruce Almighty.
Yeah, it must be a sequel. It's weird.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, but that had funnier outtakes than the film was, and that's sad. That's just pathetic. I think it's cheating when you've made a terrible film to chuck your funniest bits in during the credits.
They had so much fun making this movie.
It's a shame we couldn't translate that into the film itself.
Yes. So don't I've see been it. Reading a bunch of DC comics. In fact, wow, everything I'm going to talk about is DC, but nonetheless, I am a DC fan. I mean, I've got a Superman tattoo, so obviously I'm a DC fan.
You're a dick man.
Brightest Day, what?
You're a dick man.
Well, all men are, really. Definition. Brightest Day 19. Brightest Day is a 26-part bi-weekly series, or fortnightly series, I guess I should be more specific.
Please do.
It's basically, it's set after the latest Blackest Night, which was the Green Lantern epic in which a lot of... DC heroes and villains came back from they all came back as zombies. All the dead characters in DC came back as like zombies and fought each other and all this kind of stuff. So Brightest Day is a slightly more hopeful version of that, where all the zombies are dead, and it basically focuses on 12 resurrected heroes and villains that have been resurrected, but they don't know kind of why they've come back. So you've got Hawkman and Hawkgirl, you've got Deadman, you've got Hawk and Dove, Aquaman, so all these kind of characters are coming back to life through the power of this mysterious white lantern. Deadman, who you might remember, kind of Neil Adams, artist Neil Adams, kind of kicked Deadman off. He was an acrobat called Boston Brand who was killed by this, I think his name was the Hook, or Hook was the bad guy's name. And then he died, but he came back like as a ghost and able to inhabit other bodies. He's like a 70s character that hasn't really been around in DC for ages, but he's kind of the driving force of the Brightest Day series because the White Ring, who kind of speaks to him and tells him what to do and tells him that there's Grandmaster plan, and but he doesn't know why, and kind of odd things are happening left, right, and center. People are dying and people are coming back, and he's losing his powers, but he has to trust this White Ring. He kind of says that it's all in control. Yeah, it's pretty cool. The last issue we saw Hawkman and Hawkgirl, they broke the curse that they had on each other last issue, and then they were killed by the White Ring. And then the ring talks to Deadman and says that, you know, there's all part of plan to save the soul of Earth. This issue, Brightest Day 19, is part one of Aqua War, which is starring the new Aqualad, who is an African-American guy called Jackson Hyde. And DC have been pretty smart because this character was first seen in Brightest Day, around about the same time that the new Young Justice cartoon, I don't know if you've seen the trailers for the Young Justice cartoon, but basically it's kind of a anime visual approach to the Teen Titans. So you got Robin, you've got Superboy, you know, the younger psychic characters, but you've got, you know, Batman and Aquaman and as those kind of mentors to them, so it looks pretty good. We haven't had the Young Justice cartoon here yet, but it's airing Cartoon Network in America.
Is the Green Lantern kid in it? I can't remember the guy's name.
The what one?
The Green Lantern's, didn't he? Not Green, sorry, Green Arrow had like
a little psychic. Green Arrow, yeah, Speedy.
What's his name?
Speedy, or Arsenal, is actually.
And what's the Flash's sidekick's name?
Kid Flash, or Impulse.
This is all mixed up.
It's been a few different versions.
Why isn't he called Speedy? What the...
What?
Why isn't the Flash's little kid called Speedy?
yes. I know.
I find that bothersome.
I don't know, because he's beat it with arrows. But Brightest Day 19 is, yeah, as I said, part one of the Aqua War, which basically has kind of the rebel Atlanteans invading Earth, led by Siren and Black Manta. Black Manta is the real father of Jackson Hyde, the new Aqualad. Aquaman gets his right hand chopped off again, which is the second time in about 20 years. Mm. The first time he had his hand chopped off, well, it was bitten by piranhas, and I still don't know how that works. I thought his kind of skin was indestructible, but I'll have to pick up Moshi and see how that happened. But yeah, and he got a harpoon hand, if you remember, in the 90s, got a beard and got all morose and kind of wore a gladiator outfit. That was actually a pretty good series written by Peter David. So here he gets his hand chopped off yet again, so I don't know if he's going to get a magical hand or a harpoon hand next issue. But there's a lot to get to. It looks great. It's written, the art is by Ivan Reis and Joe Prado, two different artists, but the styles are pretty similar, so it's not jarring. I mean, you need two artists on a series that comes out every 2 weeks. But there's lots of great splash pages, and it is very epic and very cinematic. Lots of close-ups, lots of detail, lots of just anguish on people's faces. You can kind of, and just the Aquaman scenes are awesome. Like, it's kind of hard to draw Aquaman in water. It doesn't always look like he's in water.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But they do that very well here, and there's a great two-page splash where Siren is like the splash page. Where, she kind of leads her army, who all have like water-based guns, onto the beach, and you kind of see people. There's like crabs on the beach. There's like little kids falling over. There's a woman getting shot in the back, and somebody's glasses left on the beach, like over 2 pages. It looks pretty cool. So yeah, the art is fantastic. Yeah. But Brightest Day is a series definitely for DC diehards. But the trade collecting the first 12 issues is out now. It is one of those books, kind of like Kingdom Come, I guess. Great to look at, but not for newbies.
It sounds like a lot of fun with old women getting shot in the back with water pistols. That's kind of what I understood you said.
You're correct, but your tone is not indicative of the thematic issues at play in the issue.
I guess technically they are water pistols, but that's a flip.
They are. They're guns and weapons and stuff made of water, which is true. Like hard water constructs.
Ah, okay.
Pretty cool.
It's like that sort of thing. Water pistol could be a pistol made of water, or a pistol which fires water, or a fireman could be someone who puts out fires, or a Marvel superhero, maybe. I don't know. Did I blow your mind?
You always do.
Thank you. I'll mention another one I picked up in the old Melbs. I saw this for the first time. Finally found a store which stocked nearly every Cinebook comic that's come out.
Ah, awesome. Yes, I've been meaning to read more of their stuff. They're European publisher.
That's correct. And they've recently been putting out a lot of good newer stuff. Old titles have issues with ownership rights, especially anything that was collected, say, in Spirou or Tintin Magazine or any of those. Thorgal is by Rosinski and Van Ham. Gregor Rosinski is the... I don't really know his other artistic work, but Jean Van Ham wrote 13, Largo Winch, and Blake and Mortimer. 13 is probably the most recognizable one of those. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. It's kind of Conan by way of like Viking mythology. So it's got these prince. Yeah, it's like Prince Valiant in many regards. The artwork looks a bit like Prince Valiant as well. Very detailed, fine. Technical pen kind of artwork, beautifully coloured, and it's got these kind of fantastic elements to this Viking story, and the main character is actually an orphan from space, similar to Superman in many regards.
Indeed.
Yeah, but there's this sci-fi element, which I'm assuming will come back into it later on. And so far, it's been really effective at blending the fantasy, the realistic Viking stuff, you know, the tragedy of, because he meets a girl, like it starts when he's young and then he's growing through the course of the comic, which I always enjoy. Sure. So the tales are a lot of fun. You have wizards, you have like evil princes who like are gluttons, and he fights a tiger. If you don't fight like a tiger at some point, you're not doing your comic right. So yeah. Really a lot of fun. I definitely recommend picking this up if you're at all into fantasy, because it's probably the best fantasy comic I've read. Like pure fantasy, not like medieval history thing, because it's not historical. I have a lot of praise for this, but I guess if you pick one up and flick through it, you'll see why. Huge range of sort of artistic effects on show. I guess I could roughly describe what it's about. I mean, but he's an outsider raised by Vikings. They attempt to kill him to start with. He escapes, and then he meets all sorts of fantastical things along the way, and finds his true love when they're both kids, which is quite different. You know, she's not a princess; she's just a poor little girl, just like him. So, I'm going to get more of this, and then when it's done, I'd like to lend them to you. And yeah, because I think you'd like this too. So,
it's one of those that I'm familiar with, and I seem to recall there's someone on the back of some kind of winged dragon-y kind of thing. I don't know.
Maybe it's in a later volume. It could be in a later volume because I only picked up two and there's about 10. And each volume collects two volumes of the European one.
Okay.
So it's good because otherwise Cinebook would have to publish 20 volumes of this. And this is and it's in a smaller size as well. I'm just warning people. I think it's not the full-size European comic. I think it's slightly compacted down, but it's still very effective. Yeah, but that was Thorgal, Thorgal, and it's being published by Cinebook in English. And if you haven't looked at Cinebook at all, go out and buy some Cinebook books because they're great.
Cinebook, yeah.
Yes.
I have been reading the Superman 80-page Giant 2011. DC do this on occasion rather than an annual, but for their top-tier characters, they'll do like a double or triple-sized issue with a bunch of shorter stories, like an anthology.
Mm-hmm.
Not a hardcover thing, but and basically they use it as an opportunity to kind of give new writers and artists a bit of practice, I guess, and a bit of a platform. So like any kind of anthology, it's always a bit of a mixed bag, but this one's actually pretty good, and it's interesting because Superman's hardly in it, so this mainly focuses on his supporting cast. As the title says, it's 80 pages. The first story is Jor-El, who is Superman's father, Kryptonian father, and he's basically, it's his captions kind of narrating the story, and we know that he's racing to avoid soldiers. He's on Krypton before its destruction to get proof of the destruction of Krypton. Because as we all know, in the well-told tale, Jor-El, who is a scientist to Superman, he kind of knew that Krypton was going to blow up, so he made measures to send his baby Kal-El to Earth to survive, as the rest of the planet would destroy. So that's pretty good. As basically just him racing against time to go and get core samples because everybody else thinks he's like a heretic and doesn't believe in him. So it's very good. It's basically just him and his desperate desire to kind of prove that he's right and also get his son off planet. So, yeah, as a race against time, it works really well. The other one is Old Men Talking in Bars, titled. It stars Perry White, editor-in-chief of Daily Planet.
Okay.
Where Clark Kent works, and Wildcat, who's one of those 40s heroes who's been in the Justice Society of America, and they're basically talking about their sons in a bar, and they reminisce how they first met. It's got great cartoony art by Dean Haspiel, who doesn't do a lot of comics art, unfortunately, but he's a very kind of Bruce Timm-like, I guess, kind of animated, loose animated feel.
Okay.
There's another story with Jimmy Olsen, and he's got 100 clones, and they're all having brief lives and adventures, and they all die. It's okay, but the story's not one of the best ones. There's another one where Bizarro, starring Bizarro, he's the opposite of Superman, and he talks in backwards speak. And he's basically just talking to himself, and he's kind of inspired by Superman's walk across America that's happening. There's another story starring Supergirl. She meets a friend at a carnival, and then a monster gets loose, and she kind of has to go in her civvy clothes, which is interesting because the civilian clothes she wears are the same ones that her character wears in Smallville. That's written by Joe Caramanga with art by Trevor McCarthy. There's a Lois Lane, Lana Lang story in there. There's some pretty interesting ones. There's a good Superboy story set in Smallville that's in there. So if you want to know a bit more of Superman's supporting cast rather than the man himself, because it is quite, I mean, Superman and Batman both have some pretty good supporting characters. They've got quite a big, ever-growing family, and it's quite a hard to track them all down and can keep abreast of what's going on. So the Superman 80-page Giant 2011, it's a one-shot. It's made up a lot of different stories all done in one, so you don't have to worry about continued adventures. It's, and it's a good idea to do these things to kind of give new writers and artists a way of letting their work speak for itself.
It must be easier than trying to get a tenure on Superman, the big man himself.
Only the big names go on that, baby.
Yeah,
you got to prove yourself somehow.
There was a comma in there, right? Go in that comma, baby, right? I hope so. I really hope so. Yeah. That sounded interesting, actually. Yeah, I like the ones which focus on minor characters. try and explore them a bit other than just sort of talking about the main character, which I find they do, a lot of supporting characters do. I like when, say, in Batman, when Alfred's not talking about Batman or Bruce, talk about something else. You know, that stuff's more interesting. But, yeah, that's from the... Do you remember that Robert McKee book? And he says, any scene where two characters are talking about the third character is a load of bull. And I sometimes believe that. But that what you described sounded cool. On the other end of something which is nothing at all like that, and this... this is kind of, I'd hesitate to call it a comic book or a graphic novel or whatever, because it was initially released more as a picture book, kind of telling looks more like a strip cartoon, but I remember seeing this in my childhood library. It's called When the Wind Blows. It's by Raymond Briggs, and I guess to describe the artwork, do you remember the snowman that devastating childhood story where the kid has an adventure with the snowman, then the snowman melts, and it's like... Anyway, okay, you don't remember. You're the wrong age. These are like my childhood memories. But it starts off like this.
I don't remember your childhood memories.
No. You don't remember my childhood memories? Okay. But it starts off this old couple. They live in like the countryside. He reminds me a bit of like Wallace from Wallace and Gromit. And they're both just like cute little cartoon characters. They're really quite funny, like the kind of dialogue they have between each other, just mispronouncing words. And he's talking about like the growing political situation as well as he understands it, which is not at all. And then they start talking about they realize they're going to get the bomb's going to fall. Like it's escalated to that point. So he's trying to build a government regulation shelter by leaning some doors against the wall and chucking a mattress underneath it, and they're like reminiscing about the war days, and then the bomb falls and they die of radiation poisoning. And through those last scenes, they're not prepared at all. It's just like they're gonna die, and over the course of the novel their faces slowly wash out of all color, and by the end of it they're just green, splotchy, thinner, and all the dialogue and the panels are all washed out, and then they kind of die on the last page, like a few panels short of the bottom, so it's just white space on the bottom half of the page. Pretty affecting stuff. I remember I don't remember this film because it was before my time, but at the back they mentioned there's an animated version with a song by David Bowie. So I need to look that up. David Bowie's version of When the Wind Blows. But I guess if you're into anything of kind of a political message, I guess my only kind of problem with this is no one in the comics community considers it a comic for some reason, even though it is. Maybe the author distanced himself from the comics world on problem releasing it. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
even picture book was considered more respected than comic book. But that's not a criticism of the work itself. It's definitely worth checking out if you're into anything with kind of a social message. And it's surprisingly funny, and that's all down to the characters. And so when they die, it's like, they were funny, and they're dead.
So if you like Sean Tan's work, you might like
this? Yeah, yeah. Like The Rabbits. Do you remember that one? Sean Tan's The Rabbits? That's a picture book, like outright. Sean Tan wrote The Arrival, which is a wonderful graphic novel. Wordless, good one. But yeah, I guess this has that similar approach of writing books for children with like a message that that they'll hopefully take with them to adulthood. Do you know what I mean? Like manipulating kids, which I'm all for. I feel like more people have read this and they've just forgotten about it because it's something I remember quite vividly. So, I'd recommend checking it out. Go for it.
Nice. Just out this week is Batman and Robin 20, which is by the new creative team, from Green Lantern, who are working Green Lantern together. Grant Morrison was writing the series for the first, most of the 19 issues before this. He's now left to write Batman Incorporated. As we know, the current state of the Bat books in the DC Universe is that Bruce Wayne died a couple of years ago. He returned to life after fighting his way through different eras in time. And now, most recently, he revealed himself to the world, not as Batman, but as the man bankrolling Batman's adventures, and saying that he wants to start Batman Incorporated. So we have Batman Incorporated is the new series written by Grant Morrison, where Bruce Wayne, the original Batman, goes around the world and, you know, finds a Japanese Batman, and then he'll train like a... you might have seen in the news there's been a fair bit of slack because the latest issue had a French Muslim Batman. Cool. A lot of people complaining about that and whatnot. So, so Batman and Robin 20s is by the new creative team, now that Grant's left. And it is awesome. It's written by Peter J. Tomasi, who was originally an editor. He's been an editor with DC for years and years. He's only recently gone back to full-time writing in the past maybe 4 or 5 years. He wrote Nightwing for about a year before that series got cancelled. And the artist on this is Patrick Gleason, who I said worked with Peter Tomasi on the Green Lantern title. So Batman and Robin stars the original Robin, Dick Grayson, who was in the Batman 60s TV series. He is the new Batman.
Okay.
With a slightly altered costume. His Robin is Damian Wayne, who is Bruce Wayne's illegitimate son with the daughter of Ra's al Ghul, played by Liam Neeson and Ken Watanabe in Batman Begins. Mm. So that's who the Batman and Robin in this title are. The cover is by Ethan Van Sciver, who's a great, very detailed artist, and it has the two of them jumping out of a skylight, as they often do, onto the Penguin, and he's got like a bib with a cartoon lobster face on it and is firing a umbrella machine gun. Unfortunately, that scene does not appear anywhere in this comic. Nevertheless, it's a good cover.
Okay.
But it starts off pretty well. You were talking about earlier, like good character moments, kind of out of costume, and it's the first few pages are Alfred and Dick and Damian and Bruce kind of all together, and they're watching the Mark of Zorro film.
Of course.
Which is pretty cool because, as we know, that was the film which... When Bruce Wayne and his parents were leaving the cinema.
How's Bruce taking it?
His parents got shot. It was his choice to put on the Mark of Zorro. Like, he does it every year to kind of remember himself. And it's actually pretty good. It's got a good some good dialogue.
Do you reckon he saw the Antonio Banderas, Catherine Zeta-Jones version?
Well, this looks like like Douglas Fairbanks or whatever one, I guess, from the 30s. One would imagine so.
Which would make Batman, what, 90 years old then? If he saw it as a child in the 30s?
Batman was around in the 30s. Obviously, he appeared in, what, 1939.
But that's retconned, isn't it? How does it work now? So, like, when they flash back to, like, his childhood moments, do they, does it happen?
They're continually updating it.
So it's happening in the 60s or 70s now, right?
Yeah,
70s. Correct. 70s would be right.
So they actually didn't show, I think, they showed Deflatormouse or Deflatormouse in the Batman Begins film. Like, he wasn't watching the Mark of Zorro, I guess because of copyright.
Oh, yeah, it was an opera, wasn't it?
It was an opera, and he was, like, scared of the bats. Whereas this one, because obviously Zorro and Batman have a lot, you know, secret rich guys, secret caves, socialites running around in black costumes. So there's a lot of similarities. So I've always liked that connection to Mark of Zorro. So it's interesting. And can I just quote Bruce Wayne here?
Please do.
It's actually pretty interesting. Bruce Wayne is one of those characters who he almost could be a one-hit wonder. Could be, you know, something from a Charles Bronson or Chuck Norris film, like just someone seeking revenge. But he's actually quite a multifaceted character. Dick is art. Dick, the original Robin and current Batman says, Bruce, are you sure you want to watch this?
Yeah.
And Bruce Wayne says, it may have been the worst night of my life, Dick, but up until Chill, who's the guy that killed his parents, up until Chill stepped out of the shadows, it was one of the best days of my life. It wasn't often I got to spend every waking minute with both my mother and father. The whole day felt special. Looking back, this movie not only marked an ending, but a beginning of a new road, a new path.
So Chill is canon? Oh.
Joe Chill is the guy that killed Bruce Wayne's parents, yes.
I don't like that they reveal who he is, because kind of...
I think I think maybe Frank Miller did that, but even again in Batman Begins they mentioned Joe Chill. And then I think in one of the comics in like the 80s or 90s, Joe Chill kind of discovered that he killed Bruce Wayne and somehow managed to create Batman without piercing the identity. So all the other villains like killed him or ganged up on him.
Oh, fair enough. But I thought Jack Nicholson killed Bruce Wayne's parents.
Oh, you Wally.
I was going to ask, so when Bruce came back from the time, his journeys through time, he's decided just to leave the Batman mantle off altogether, right? Is that his thing?
He's still Batman, so there was two Batman. Dick Grayson, the original Robin, is called Batman, and he runs around in Gotham.
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne is still called Batman, and he runs around all around the world recruiting other Batman to his army.
Okay. Because, yeah, my question was, surely people will now be watching him more carefully, knowing that he's bankrolling this guy. I'd expect one of the villains to try and hold Bruce Wayne captive.
Well,
the
interesting thing is, I don't know if you remember Hush, and now I'm getting really geeky, which I think was Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee series in 2003. Yes. Tommy Elliot, who was one of Bruce Wayne's childhood friends, he was like the bandaged bad guy, Hush.
Of course.
He got his face remade to look like Bruce Wayne, so now Alfred and a few of Bruce's associates use that, and they kind of tell him, and they basically imprison him in Wayne Tower and tell Hush, who looks just like Bruce Wayne, goes to all the social functions to keep up appearances.
Why would he keep up appearances? I thought he hates Bruce Wayne for some reason.
He does, but, you know, he's got Machiavellian schemes and stuff. So people think Bruce Wayne and Batman are two different people.
Is the Riddler still, like, working on the side of good? It's been so long since
the latest issue of Batman.
Yeah.
Written and drawn by Tony Daniel, showed Riddler becoming a bad guy again, and he had a daughter. So, and his daughter's like a young girl with a green question mark costume. So, I don't know what's going on.
Sexy Riddler.
It's quite a surprise, possibly. Yeah. Batman and Robin 20, awesome issue, and it's got some good character moments. Apart from Batman and his family watching the Zorro, basically, it's a good way to start a new arc. It's a very simple story. Grant Morrison, even though he knew how to write Batman, often had a way, especially in Batman and Robin, of making things so complex and confusing that it's hard to keep track of what was happening from month to month in between monthly issues.
Yeah.
Here, it's a very simple story. There's a guy that kind of jumps off half nude of a building. He's got like these yellow glowing wings super glued to his back. So Batman and Robin are kind of investigating that, and then they get attacked by Man-Bat. And he's got like glowing blood, and it's actually a pretty good issue. There's a good moment in there when Damian Wayne, who's like a real mean kind of arrogant Robin, he's kind of he gets told off in the morgue by Commissioner Gordon because Damian's like not really disrespecting the dead. So it's good, very good writing by Tomasi. Patrick Gleason is an awesome artist, always has been, and he just really knows how to do good action scenes. So, I'm curious. They're off to a good start. So if you haven't read Batman and Robin for a while, this series sets it up pretty well. And as I said, it's a very simple, streamlined storyline. So thank you, DC, for continuing to put out good Batman books.
It's been interesting this last couple of years with Grant Morrison doing this stuff. I mean, I've not been reading any of it, but it's all sounded kind of interesting, like what he's been doing, and people have said it's confusing, but I suspect it's because he's thinking big picture. So if you read them all in order, it would make perfect sense. Probably
he doesn't write small stories, you know. He's always got a master plan, and that's why a lot of guys like him and Geoff Johns with DC, who's doing the Green Lantern and co-writing Brightest Day, and on the Marvel side of Brian Michael Bendis, who's, you know, killing the Ultimate Spider-Man as we speak and creating all the Avengers titles. Guys like that are kind of the architects of these superhero universes. They're given so much leeway because they do see the big picture and so much potential. I mean, you know, none of us would have guessed that, we would have guessed that they would have killed Bruce Wayne and it would have come back. That was obvious. But we never would have guessed that, you know, his illegitimate son would become Robin, or Dick Grayson would become Batman, or that, you know, Bruce Wayne would say that he's bankrolling Batman, or that there'd be
like
international
Spider-Man
Batman.
Move, yeah.
These are all good surprises.
The international Batman thing, definitely, that's the first bit that I've heard that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's the first one I've heard that didn't seem like a logical, like Dick Grayson as Batman seemed like a logical thing to do. Like a son of Batman seemed like a gimmick that I was just waiting for, but this like Batman Internet, what he gave it, like Batman Inc., was that it? Incorporated?
Batman Incorporated, yeah.
It was actually, and it's a good name, so
yeah,
like, that's unusual.
Grant Morrison loves the weird and wacky Batman stories from the 50s and 60s where he was like, you know, battling dinosaurs and turning different colors and whatever, and he alludes to those a lot in his Batman stories. And Batman Incorporated was kind of inspired by the, I think it was called the Club of Heroes or something, where there are a couple issues in the 50s and 60s Batman where there was like an Indian chief Batman and a Mexican Batman and whatever. So he's kind of inspired by those, Grant Morrison inspired by those stories, and kind of, I'm going to make this wacky and weird stuff work, and I'm going to make it canon. And he did.
Yeah.
Give him his due.
Until it gets retconned. Do you think it will?
Yeah. I don't think so. This is interesting as a new status quo. I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's not like the spider clone saga.
No, it sounds like a really cool idea, but I just suspect at one point when he's out of the picture, they'll go, oh, this is too hard. Let's take him back to his roots. And then they'll trim all that stuff off again, which they keep doing whenever anything interesting comes up. I just think the worst.
Batman's been a pretty stable character, you know, unlike Superman, who's had a fair few retcons over the years. Batman has been a pretty, because he's such, he can be a sci-fi hero, he can be a dark vigilante, he can work with the Justice League, he can work as an action hero, he can work as a detective. He's a very versatile hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he can appear in Batman the Brave or the Bold cartoon, but he can also, you know, appear in the Batman Arkham Asylum game. Or
we should really do a whole episode on this, because we're going to keep going and we're probably way over time as it is. So, have you got any?
The
more?
Last one I just still want to mention is Deus Ex.
Thank you,
Deus Ex, Human Revolution, which is a first issue of a new miniseries, also by DC Comics, and this is based on the third in the Deus Ex video game. I think there's a upcoming prequel also called Human Revolution. This is by Robbie Morrison with art by Trevor Hairsine, which is very Brian Hitch-like. It's detailed, it's sketchy. It's basically set in a future where a lot of people get cybernetic implants, and the hero here is basically, you know, all four of his limbs are basically cybernetic. He rescues a girl who's a daughter of a big head of a conglomerate who gives cybernetic implants to all these people. Full of action, lots of gunplay, a fair bit of profanity and violence, but it's a great-looking comic. You know, sometimes video game comic adaptations of video games are a bit hit and miss, but DC, they're pretty good with this. They do World of Warcraft. They don't Gears of War. The Assassin's Creed comic is surprisingly good, and this is another one that can go on to that. So the video game, which I'm not that familiar with, but the trailer for the new one looks pretty awesome. I think it comes out in May or something.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are into video games, then these kind of adaptations are a good hook for a lot of people to get into comics.
Right.
You know, a lot of video gamers to get into comics. So it's kind of got that frenetic pace and the realistic art, and it sets up the setting. I mean, I was never at a loss to understand what was going on here. It's kind of dark and gritty, and not very superhero-y, but more sci-fi action-y.
Cool. That's like DC, it. Was it?
Yeah, DC, Deus Ex, Human Revolution.
Cool stuff. All right, that was all I had for this week. Next week, I think we'll be doing a little mini Valentine's Day special. It's after Valentine's, but who cares? We make the rules, and guys always forget when Valentine's Day is, so it's appropriate. We'll be doing maybe a little in-depth review of a new graphic novel.
Yep.
Can we say what it is?
Ivy by Oni Press, black and white. It's only recently come out, so it actually looks pretty good. So, yeah, we'll be talking about a few different romance comics, of which there are a surprising number. Romance is in, "Hi, Brad, why would you marry me?" It'd be more mature readers kind of romance comics, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff. And there's also, if we're lucky, we'll have a guest on who will tell us about romance manga, which will be the like a mix of the kind of overt romance-y stuff. And that's pretty cool stuff as well. So I hope that happens too. I just have to tee it up. So,
cool.
Yeah. But that's next week. We hope you've enjoyed this week's show. My name's Mladen.
My name's Chris. You can email us at Chris, K-R-I-S, at extrasequential.com, and get all our previous episodes on iTunes and extrasequential.com.
Music for the show has been at purgeaudit.com, and you can look Purge Audit up on Facebook now. I finally
wow. And you've been putting a few new songs up as well, I've noticed. You've been quite busy the last few days.
Yeah, I know, right? I've got a really cool project coming up, so... with another dude, it's going to be really awesome. So yeah,
cool.
And if you want to suggest a topic for a show, please contact us at the address Chris mentioned before.
Chris@extrasequential.com. Yes, we'd be very happy to hear from you. Thank you for listening as always, and we hope you have a delightful Valentine's Day.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye now.